neoplastic, which is kind of a, you know, very unusual. So it's kind of a themed around IPF UIP in different aspects. I kind of thought interesting. And I will start with a mundane, you know, something about tumor. So I'll start with the first paper, Sasaki et al. Is from Japan. And as the title indicates, they reported AKT1 mutations in peripheral bronchiolar papillomas, but not in bronchiolar adenomas. So before you know, I get to the you know, main area, I'll just kind of remind you with a few like a glossaries, you know. So the squamous cell papilloma and glandular papilloma, mixed squamous cell and glandular papillomas are endobronchial, kind of like a luminal thing. And they can be mostly in the larger airways, but it can be in the smaller airways also. And then, of course, the bronchiolar adenomas that I will go over a little later. And squamous cell papilloma has a strong association with HPV, like in the laryngeal and tracheal squamous cell papillomas. So it's not actually in the topic for this paper. So mainly about glandular and mixed papilloma, mixed glandular and squamous papilloma that are not HPV associated. And they can be either in the central or peripheral bronchiolar location, but they have intraluminal endobronchial involvement. Whereas the more recently, the published CMP-tesselated muconodular papillary tumor is not within the lumen. They grow along the bronchiolar area, so peribronchiolar, but not intraluminal. And it has a strict criteria. It has a ciliated glandular squamous cells and the papillary as a namesake. And then later, I think I the reviewed this paper in 2019 when it was published in by the MSK group. So the bronchiolar adenoma encompasses a little more. So it does not have to have a ciliated or a papillary element, but they are kind of a cousin, you know, so they're in the similar location, but without endobronchial involvement. So in fact, new WHO that is coming soon put this together, the BA slash CMPT. So they put as the same kind of a group, you know, in the same group. So the GPNMP and BA occur in the different locations. One is within the lumen, and this is around the bronchiolar, peribronchiolar or alveolar location, but in the very the high power morphology may mimic each other. So there are some morphologic similarities and also shares molecular changes. That is the BRAF mutation that can be seen in both conditions. So the aim of this study is to see if these two groups, two entities, GPNMP and BA, represent the same tumor or not. That's the purpose of the this paper by looking at the detailed histopathology and genetic analysis. So they found 11 peripherally located tumors in one institution in Japan over about 11 years. So there was original diagnosis of CMPT, MP, solitary peripheral ciliated, GP, whatever that means, and solitary peripheral papilloma. So those cases were re-reviewed and reclassified by three pathologists as GPNMP versus BA. So they kind of regrouped by the re-review of the slides, and they measure the thickness of the epithelial layer and did a bunch of molecular studies and immunohistochemistry as well. And so by those very kind of detailed molecular studies, they found, and the morphology first, so they classified as a four cases MPs and seven as the BAs. And among these BAs, they subclassified as the one with more papillary elements versus not. So the two papillary, one papillary slash flat, and then four pure flat. So they kind of delved into a little more morphologic details for seven BAs they reviewed. And the mean thickness of the epithelial layers is much thicker in MPs than flat BAs, of course. And then in between for the papillary BAs. And the molecular findings were listed in the table two, but I'll just explain to you. So AKT1 mutations were only found in GPMP, but not in flat BAs. Whereas the two papillary BAs, they had the AKT mutations. So the flat BAs probably, so their conclusion was flat BAs probably is not, related to the MP and GP. However, BA with more papillary features may be related to GPMP. But, I thought, we are not going to do AKT mutation study to tell them apart because I guess in a way it won't matter. So I think the gist of this paper is, they kind of describe a little more details molecularly and morphologically for these benign entities so that we can tell them a little better. Because, the all of you who are looking at, consult cases, I wouldn't say so common, but, it's not vanishingly rare. We get this consult and it just makes sure it's not diagnosed as a carcinoma. I think that's the point. So in a way, the most important thing is, there are these benign entities, they may be related somewhat in some the subtypes, but, there are these multiple different kind of molecular signatures. And I think the most important is P40 and the P63, looking at the two basal layers. So all of these entities have those two layers. So I think that's the most important point for this paper. And, I didn't show, but if you look at the pictures of, this paper, figure two and three, they really shows nicely about their paper, their kind of a GPMP versus BA. So I guess, the BA is maybe something we need to remember so that we don't go overboard, not all abnormal the glandular proliferation in the periphery of the lung is, adenocarcinoma. I think that's the most important point. Any comments?
There, the diagnosis of BA was similar to that paper from Memorial where they sort of defined that. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's, actually same. Yeah.
And some of those cases were actually microscopic.
Yeah, microscopic, yeah. And, I recently had lobectomy. So because we get, all those screening CT, and they find more and more those little, distal. And they tried to figure out and they couldn't by biopsy. And, sometimes they ended up having lobectomy. So I have like a four tray full of slides and there's a two slides have the lesion that happened to be BA. So I think, that something is happening more often, I suppose. So in fact, I get that the previous paper published in AJSP in 2018. And yeah, everything is the same for as far as the definition goes. So I even tried to figure out if there's the same author, Japanese, you know, because the first author of the 2018 paper was by Sasaki et al. I mean, the previous paper was from Chang, but there were like a bunch of Japanese names in there. So I thought they maybe overlap, but it didn't. So anyway, if you don't have any question, I'll go on to the next papers that seem to be a little more discussion worthy. So the second paper is by Ricciardi et al. And I know Tom and Jeff are involved as the central pathologist who reviewed all the pathology. So you can chime in anytime. So the BRAVE cohort refers to bronchial sample collection for novel genomic test. I suppose it was initiated by a company called the Veracyt, who developed the molecular classifier. So anyway, this cohort was recruited from 30 sites in the US and Europe over a 6-year period. And they underwent transbronchial biopsy for transcriptomic RNA-seq, and they were used to train a machine learning algorithm as a preparation for the further studies. And then also these patients had clinically indicated surgical biopsy for diagnosis. So either surgical biopsy, transbronchial biopsy, or cryobiopsy for pathology. They were reviewed by Tom, Jeff, and one more pathologist. And available the HRCT scans were viewed by both local radiologists and the central radiologists, two thoracic radiologists. So radiologists reviewed by, they used both local radiologists and the central radiologists, but the pathology was reviewed by the central expert thoracic pathologists. So Invisia genomic classifier was developed by this machine learning and the whole transcriptome RNA sequencing. And there were a few studies that described their findings for initial proof of concept, and the one later study that was published in Lancet Respiratory Medicine in 2019. And that was almost similar to the current paper, except that it's a two independent cohorts. So for this classifier used 190 genes signature, expression signature, and they did a lot of kind of a study to make the cutoff score. So it's a binary, so UIP versus non-UIP, not UIP. So that's that. And then there have been three BRAVE studies. As I said, the most recent one was in Lancet Respiratory Medicine 2019. And when I read it, it's pretty much similar to the current one. So this is kind of a follow-up study to validate the previous study using the new group of BRAVE patients allocated for independent clinical validation and evaluation of the combined accuracy of this Invisia genomic classifier. And it's kind of a, the main purpose of actually for both studies were trying to bypass the pathology. So, you know, it's like a real world setting, not the, you know, expert the radiologist, but the, you know, the local radiologists do all kinds of different kind of a way of giving the diagnosis, not exactly following the Fleischner classification, but they have their own, you know, institutional kind of a way of doing it. So using that plus this Invisia genomic classifier, from the transbronchial biopsy that can be done in any, you know, the local hospitals. So using those two information, they can increase the sensitivity quite a bit. Actually, that's the purpose of it. But along the way, they did a lot of detailed description of the study. So they started with a 447 brave patients cohort, but 227 was used for the other study published in 2019. And this study started with 220 patients, but they excluded a lot of patients for many different reasons, for including something like shipping problem, or there is an issue of the initial biopsy, all kinds of different reasons. So that is cohort description is in figure one. So they ended up using 96 patients for this study. So again, pathology was reviewed by three expert pathologists as 2018 ATS criteria as UIP. Or probable UIP. And you know, the prior study was using the verbiage like a favor UIP or difficult UIP. And that was lumped as a probable UIP this time. And if not UIP, they gave alternative diagnosis. They were listed in figure three. I'll try to show you that figure, because in each case, the cases were listed with a specific diagnosis. So then radiology again was reviewed by the original pathologists and also by the expert pathologists. And they used both information. And the original HRT CT scan again used all kinds of different verbiage. So those were reviewed by not the expert on anything, but they said qualified reviewers to convert their wording to Fleischner diagnostic category, typical, probable, indeterminate, and features most consistent with non-UIP, like alternative diagnosis. So they divided into four Fleischner category from the whatever verbiage they used in the local hospital. And then they did a molecular testing on that transbronchial biopsy that had in this cohort. So the one thing I was gonna ask Tom and Jeff was, you didn't review any transbronchial biopsy, right?
Oh yeah, we saw quite a few.
You did?
Oh yeah.
Oh, I see. So you actually saw the biopsy?
Yes.
And then I wasn't even sure that they used the fresh tissue or the paraffin tissue.
They use fresh tissue from the transbronchial biopsies, and they're doing RNA studies, so that's why there were handling issues, because it's pretty sensitive. That they a lot of specimens degraded.
I see. So they made a slide and they used and the fresh tissue for the RNA.
Well, if they got four transbronchial biopsies, they might use one for the RNA and then the other three. So we didn't actually see the tissue that was analyzed.
I see. So that was not entirely clear to me. And also, one other question that I had was, when the biopsy was done, like a time difference between the original biopsy or CT scan versus transbronchial biopsy?
I'm not sure about that. My impression was they were done at the same time.
At the same time, I see.
Yeah.
So anyway, that was the issue that I was wondering about. Anyway, so they did molecular testing and they did all kinds of statistical analysis I wouldn't delve into because I cannot understand entirely. And then, so when they reviewed their NVIDIA classifier information against the pathology, so that's the gold standard. So when they, with their scoring system, specificity was 92.1%. So it's pretty good, but the sensitivity was 60.3%. And then this is actually the point of this paper. When they use this individual classifier information to the local radiologist's reading, they increase their sensitivity from 34% to 79.2%. So, you know, those like a remarkable jump of the sensitivity from 34 to 79, those two were, you know, the both were shown in the table 4 and 5. But what I was noted was I'll try to share. Okay, so do you see the screen?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is that the figure. So each case, they listed all these diagnoses, pathology diagnosis, and the right hand column is all the expert radiologist diagnosis. So it, all these specific diagnoses, you know, by side by side, and the classifier score, they put like 0.87 as their cutoff, and they looked at the sensitivity from this kind of a figure. So again, if I go to the table 2 and 3, actually table 4 and 5. Okay, no, not this one. So local radiology, okay, so you see this increase when you put the NVIDIA classifier, it becomes this high from here. But the local radiologist sensitivity was already higher. So as we all know, the radiologists are good at finding classic ones, but not so classic ones. And the NVIDIA can really increase the sensitivity when the equivocal or not so classic radiology findings. So that was their kind of a main finding. And it's interesting, specificity went down actually from 96 to 90%. So, all these kind of things, what I was wondering was, you know, transbronchial biopsy may not necessarily have all this fibrosis because, you know, we see transbronchial biopsy as the first time approach for UIP patient. Oftentimes, we don't have a whole lot of changes. So I suppose some transbronchial biopsy may not have all, you know, changes, but molecular classifier can find some molecular signature. So I was wondering, you know, it's like a field effect or something. So that was actually my question when I saw this paper. What do you think, Tom?
I think that's the point, that there may be some sort of field effect, or the genes in what is otherwise probably normal lung still reflect what's going on in the rest of the lung. Jeff, do you have a comment?
Jeff, are you there? Maybe not there. Anyone? Have any comment?
Well, you can see where this is heading. I mean, Medicare loves this because it doesn't need a biopsy. So you have, if you have a local radiologist that is indeterminate and you have this molecular classifier and it otherwise fits with IPF, then you don't have to go to a biopsy of any kind, cryobiopsy or surgical biopsy.
Yeah, that's right. And even that may not be all that. So, I mean, it's like a proof of concept, but you know, two major publishers are published in Lancet, and then now it's a Blue Journal. So I guess it's looming, you know, it's coming.
I was wondering if any of your clinicians already use it, because I think Veracyte offers it already commercially.
Yeah, it's being used here by clinicians at Good Sam Hospital.
I see.
Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah, we just are bringing that online here literally as we speak, and haven't enrolled anyone yet, but plan to soon to send that sample off once they get tissue available, actually.
So it's kind of very interesting concept. So, you know, we need to know about, maybe it's not changing overnight, but it's coming. And then
one comment about this thing, Joanne, is that the classifier was trained on pathologic UIP. The classifier was not trained on IPF. So chronic HP that looks has a UIP pattern is not infrequently positive, but that's not so bad these days because that's one of those quote chronic fibrotic ILDs that's going to be getting antifibrotic therapy anyway.
I see. Okay. So like how about the connective tissue disease associated like RA ILD?
Same thing. If we, the pathologists, thought it looked like UIP, then that's what the classifier was trained to. So some of those are going to be connective tissue disease and some are going to be chronic HP and some are obviously going to be IPF, probably the majority.
I see. Okay. Well, there must be a lot of fine points that, but that's the gist of what I understood from this paper. And the next one is a little different take, but also about UIP-IPF issue. So this is not like anything, it's more like a more conceptual thing than diagnostic thing like the previous paper. And this one is looking at the transcriptome analysis, the fibroblastic fossa in IPF. And they try to look at the key pathways. So instead of, like single cell RNA from the dissolved tissue, they try to look at the intact, milieu by doing laser capture microscopy. So they are claiming that they are looking at the transcriptional signature in the, they say, the fibroblast in situ. So it's like a more intact tissue environment as opposed to like a dissolved tissue in the, ground up tissue. So that's the thing. And as you can imagine, there's a lot of issue in the, expression. So they use a lot of advanced bioinformatics. And I wouldn't pretend I understand any of that. But they use a novel data mining strategy. So like all kinds of, comprehensive bioinformatics. And they used something called weighted gene co-expression network analysis, WGCNA. And then they said eigengen-based approach. And I never heard that word before, so I Googled it. So eigengen, they didn't even explain what the eigengen was in the paper when I looked through it. So I Googled it and it's term used for genetics and mathematics. I couldn't even understand the first verbiage, the first paragraph. So I had to rely on the example. So that made me understood that. Messenger RNA or gene expression of genes across the sample. So some kind of a common, thread. That's what they call the eigengen. So they use a lot of tactics in the complex bio, like a messy bio, information to delve into the gist of the information by using advanced bioinformatics. So they use the frozen tissue, that's the thing. And they did a laser capture microscopy and they got about 3 to 6 captures in each case to get the RNA. And they also looked at the RNA scope for in situ hybridization. So look at in situ. And also they did an in vitro assay from the cell culture to look at the molecular imprint, they actually is real or not. So as you can see, it's a very comprehensive study and very sophisticated molecular study. So what they found was WG and CNA identified clusterial genes associated with cell cycle, inflammation, differentiation, translation. It's all these things are involved. And a collagen eigengen analysis revealed TGF-beta-1. We know TGF-beta is associated with the fibrosis. So they found TGF-beta-1 and then a Rho-A kinase. And then interestingly, TSC2, that's like tuberous sclerosis, like in the lamb, and RHEB axis, the pathway was involved as the major signaling clusters associated with collagen gene expression. So when they did a functional analysis for this TSC2 RHB axis regulating TGF beta 1, they found it really was involved in the mesenchymal cells. So they kind of proved that's real. That's what they say. So what they say is that their human tissue-based approach with advanced bioinformatics was effective to identify transcriptional node. I have never heard this word before. So I guess kind of cluster of like a genes associated with a fibroblast and myofibroblast in fibroblastic foci and TSC2 RHEB axis as a potential target. So they are just going one step further. That could be the future target for interfering this fibrosis, assuming that fibroblast foci leading the fibroblastic pathway in the IPF. So when I read this paper, one thing that come across my mind was, there are a lot of different types of fibroblasts, like in the organizing pneumonia or even DAD in the interstitial septa. So those of fibroblasts, have the different transcriptional node or whatever expression or not, so that's, kind of a screening for other study, but I don't think I can do this kind of a very sophisticated study. So, I wouldn't be able to do immediately, but it's something I was thinking someone can do,
Well, that's the obvious question. Of course, you could just take wound healing as an example. You could just take tissue from an abdominal wound.
I know. Yeah. What's the difference? So what's special about fibroblastic foci,
Exactly.
So that was kind of screaming for more study, but it's more conceptual, thing, although it is claiming it may be the target, but we have seen so many of those, came in. Go without going above the radar, And then for the interest of time, I'm going to the next one. That is a another paper for fibroblast foci, but this is totally different thing. It's an AI. It's more for quantitation of those morphologic parameters. So this is another area, with a digital pathologies like coming on the horizon. So, we have all big data on the digital, format, then it's coming, So I think it's in human pathology. I guess it didn't make to Blue Journal, but it's from Finland, and it's basically tried to quantify. It's not for diagnosis per se, but they try to quantify the fibroblastic foci, interstitial mononuclear inflammation. So like the number of inflammatory cells or the area of inflammatory cells, intraalveolar macrophages using deep convolutional neural network, CNN, and their role as a prognostic biomarker. So this is time is more kind of a, if we can use as a biomarker. So that was the purpose of this paper. And the study population was the Finnish IPF registry. was diagnosis proven by central pathologists. And they chose one most representative H&E slide from surgical lung biopsy, explant, and autopsy. And the number of patients were not that many, only 71. So you can imagine this is not a huge number for, AI. I heard the AI can tell the man versus woman or, human versus non-human takes like, several million, pictures to teach the AI, but 71 obviously is not a big number. So they had to use a lot of tricks, which I have to confess I couldn't understand exactly, but they did all kinds of tricks to get over the limit of those limited kind of a number of cases they used. And then AI model for data of the surface area. So they used both surface areas and number of areas. So both the number of the foci versus number of areas for both inflammatory cells, all the parameters that they used. And then they used the search column biopsy for quantitation, but they used mostly autopsy and explants for testing lung tissue recognition, like where is the alveolar space, where is the septa, or that kind of thing. So, you know, you may have noticed that explant, we look at it, even if we do really nice, like, you know, inflation, they look a little different from the surgical lung biopsies, you know. So I guess that may have been the reasons I couldn't, why they used that, but maybe that's the reason. So anyway, explant and autopsy were teaching the, you know, topography of the lung, whereas the surgical lung biopsy was for teaching what is the, you know, fibroblastic foci, what is the, you know, inflammatory cell, that kind of things. And then it's interesting that they pointed out was they had a hard time to teach what is fibroblastic foci versus organized pneumonia. And I kind of chuckle, sometimes we, you know, struggle also, you know. So at the end, they couldn't make the clear, make them distinguish the fibroblastic focus versus organized pneumonia, but they kind of brushed off that, you know, in UIP, you don't have that many, the OP by definition anyway. So they kind of gave up on that issue. So again, the truth is by pathologist. A pulmonary pathologist annotated manually. So the AI performance was compared against the human eyes count. So that's that. And so by using that as the parameter, they found a large area of a fibroblastic foci predicted poor prognosis and a low DLCO. So like low survival and low DLCO. And interestingly, high numbers of interstitial mononuclear cells and intraalveolar macrophages associated with a better prolonged survival and high the FVC. So that's kind of opposite. The fibroblastic foci predicts worse and the opposite for the other parameters. So they said this kind of proof of concept, they can use this AI for, you know, counting. So I guess it may be coming also, you know, who wants to count the fibroblastic focus or inflammatory cells, right? But, you know, if it matters, the AI may be helpful. Any comment?
We're cheaper than AI.
For now.
Right now, yeah.
So we have 5 minutes. So I'll just go on to the last one. And this is, again, it's a very sophisticated one. It's a well beyond just looking at the H&E, because that was a mainstay of all these papers that we probably reviewed. And I have a few in the notation. And one is by Anya and our group, I think. And the title is a tissue-specific immunopathology and fatal COVID-19. So this is like to the max molecular study. If you look at the, you know, all the figures, they just did like your eyes will pop out, you know? So they did a lot of molecular study on this one. So their question was, if the damaging inflammation is due to direct reaction to the COVID virus or independent immunologic process, regardless of the presence of COVID or not. So that's their main question. So they did a study to better understand this connection among viral presence, inflammation, and organ injury. And what they did, a postmortem examination of patients with a postmortem diagnosis of COVID-19 by PCR confirmation, and had lower respiratory tract infection. And they have very short the death to autopsy time. So it's like less than a day. so that they had a good RNA. And 37 tissue sites sampled according to standardized protocol for histologic and RNA analysis, including 23 sites from the respiratory tract. And those were fixed with formalin and treated for triazole for some molecular study, snap frozen, and also stored at minus 80s. And they did some tissue work for inflammation scoring. And they also did a multiplex immunofluorescence on paraffin tissue for CD34, CD68, I don't even know, MRP8, CD4, CD8, CD20. So it's kind of the some inflammatory cell signatures and viral RNA and protein detection. So they not only look at the viral RNA, they also look at the spike protein expression by looking at immunochemistry. And also they did a randomly selected PCR, that thing also. And then they did one more thing, some subgenomic analysis to see if those virus are active or not. So they really did a massive molecular study, not just the is there or not, you know, they even look at the virus was still proliferating, that kind of issue. So what they found was COVID virus distribution to tissue inflammation was mainly involved the lung and the reticuloendothelial system, that is the lymph node and spleen, but not in other tissues. So the virus actually, was present only in those three organs, lung, lymph node, and spleen, but not in other organs in their study. In some cases, inflammation was present in the lung without detectable virus. Conversely, even at the time of death, some were 42 days after illness's onset, the viral products, not only the presence, but the subgenomic RNA was present. In other words, they were still proliferating, could be detected in numerous tissues, but dissociated from host inflammatory response. So without too much inflammation. So their conclusion was significant component of immune-mediated virus-independent immunologic process as a primary mechanism, and as a principal damage to the lung, but not virus itself. So their take is that main reason that antiviral therapies has no effect on the second phase of COVID-19 patients, maybe due to that dissociated the inflammatory response that has nothing to do with the virus itself, but more immune reaction that's not necessarily associated with the virus, presence of virus per se. So that's why in that stage, corticosteroid works better, is the only thing that is effective. That was their conclusion. Any question? So I heard, you know, with the variant viruses, you know, there are from the South Africa and England, whatever countries, you know, the kids, the younger, either even pediatric patients or, you know, adolescent or young adults get more infection, and they tend to have more vigorous immune response. So we will see, you know, maybe hear more about this, I suppose.
Anybody have any speculation as to what is inciting the inflammation away from the virus?
I mean, like a triggering, you know, kind of almost like autoimmune, you know, reaction.
Okay, but you know, why the lung, I guess, or I suppose there's other sites in the body are involved.
Yeah, so
well.
The lung is there. I mean, is the primary site of infection. So the lung is the inciting triggering thing is in the lung already. So maybe, I don't know. And then lung is a very immunologically active organ, you know, and all those macrophages are very, very active.
It seems like also the lung is one of the very few organs where we actually can find the virus. When we looked for the virus, we basically only found it in the lung. I think there are a few reports from the placenta and maybe a kidney and the heart, but that seems to be very rare. And maybe that's another reason.
And then another thing is that we saw massive neutrophil inflammation in young adults who died. We saw, but there was no capillaritis or anything, but it's like massive neutrophil everywhere in the alveolar space, interstitial septa, like flooded with the neutrophils. That was very interesting also. So there must be some even different pathways in terms of immunologic reaction. But whatever it is, I hope a vaccine works and sort of can travel. Well, we are on the top of the hour, and I hope a spring is around the corner.
Thank you, Joanne. Have a good day.
Thank you,
Joanne.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.